Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. This is the Engagement Hour and I am Ted Maxwell. As always, I've got Matt Neely behind the glass keeping me on time and target and as well as picking the tunes for the day. Matt, I told you when I came in last night, I had the opportunity, got Cody Ritchie, got a couple tickets and got to go up to see the Rams. You know, I grew up in LA, as you know, and, and some of the folks that listen know, I grew up in the LA area, so I've been a Rams fan all my life, except for those years they were in St. Louis. They were banned. But what a game, and what a, I mean, obviously it was a good game as a Rams fan.
Convincing win, sure.
It was probably a slight advantage, Vikings fans in the stadium. But I've really got to give the Bidwell family credit. I know you were talking about some of it in the news, some of what they did. They flew two of the team planes out to bring the team, the families. They brought some pets out, you know, because some of the families, I believe the Staffords were actually in the areas that were burning. So, I mean, so much going on out there. And the whole day was a lot of portion of the game, the whole pregame and a lot throughout the game was about L.A. But what amazed me is they literally turned the stadium, State Farm Stadium, into a Los Angeles stadium. I mean, tons of paint. Mm-hmm. So they covered up all the red. You had the Rams and the Los Angeles in the end zones. You had the logo on. My understanding is the guys working the board were the actual folks that worked the board in SoFi.
Amazing.
Out in California.
Okay.
So,
well, and they even said, some of the reports I saw said even local businesses surrounding that were some of the fans would be stopping by for meals or to stay or whatever were having deals where they would donate portions of the proceeds to the wildfire relief efforts.
Yeah, it was, we got up a little early perhaps and maybe hit one of the bars over at Westgate before we went into the game. And it was interesting, a Vikings fan came over to us and you know, he says, hey, we feel kind of bad. This really isn't fair. And I'm going, okay, where's this guy? I didn't go. How long has he been partying? And he just wanted to apologize for everything Los Angeles is going through. We had to explain to him we were all from Tucson, Arizona. So it wasn't, you know, we didn't want him to think that we, you know.
It's okay for him to give you, those LA fans, a dirty look.
Exactly.
The ones from Tucson.
Yeah, you can be against this. But it was, I was just amazed, and everybody that has been with the organizations, talked with the Bidwell family and what the Cardinals did, you know, yes, supporting an NFC West team is good, but they went above beyond, and it was amazing. My favorite moment, though, the box next to us was 100% Vikings fans. I mean, just a ton of them. And I'm sitting, I leaned over, talked to one of the guys, go, oh, this is kind of awkward. You know, now, we only had about half of our folks wearing Ram stuff. And the guy goes, yeah, he goes, it's really hard on me. He goes, my wife, the one up there, she's a rabid Vikings fan. He goes, I'm a Bears fan. And I said, well, that's too bad, but really? The Bears fan married the Vikings fan? He goes, yeah, it's tough sometimes. So as the Rams were scoring early in the game, I'd look over at him. He'd wink. I'd reach over across the box, give him a little high five that his wife couldn't see. And at some point when the Rams really opened it up, he goes, you need to start rooting for the Vikings, because if this continues, I'm in a lot of trouble. And I was like, right. Well, it was a great event. And I just wanted to make sure the Bidwells, you know, a lot of times people look at some of these franchise
open
owners
a training
and the
facility. Just like, it's like, whatever you guys need, we'll do it. So good for them.
They did it. So, all right. So for the rest of the show, I'm going to be bringing on Colonel Brant Putnam, the wing commander out of the 62nd Wing, Arizona Air National Guard. A lot to learn about that organization. That's one I served in from 99 to 2013, flew out there. And obviously I served a couple more years in the Guard. But when we come back, he will join us and I'll get some water and coffee and see if I can get away some of this scratchy throat from yesterday's game. Thank you for tuning in. It's 10:30 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back. Good morning and welcome back to Jump in Tucson, the Engagement Hour. So we just in this studio just jumped to attention and came to a brace, and Matt's back there going, oh, that's interesting in there. No, appreciate you playing that. A lot of people don't understand the difference between the National Guard and the Air Force, but the National Guard is part of the Air Force. It's one and the same. And we basically play that at the end of all of our ceremonial functions. So so today I'm very privileged to have Colonel Brant Putnam, the wing commander of the 162nd. I've known Brant for a long time. He's now commanding the wing, which is much more than just the largest Step 16 training wing in the world. And you'll learn more about that opportunity today. Brant's got over 4,000 hours flying the F-16, and he's got quite a story behind him. So, Colonel Putnam, Brant, glad to have you join me today.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. One of the things we try to do on this show is it's all about trying to encourage people to get engaged. We, you know, as citizens of the greatest country in the world, we've got a lot of rights, but we've also got a lot of responsibilities, and one of them is being involved. And that's quite often through service, service through nonprofits, service through as first responders, members of the military. So it's great to have you on, and I appreciate it. And part of the show is telling stories through the eyes of the guests. So how'd you get started in the Air National Guard?
Yeah, I think really, if I really look back on it, I think I probably watched Top Gun, too many times. I just really wanted to be a fighter pilot as I was getting out of high school. Went to the U of A, and I also joined the Air National Guard as a way to pay for it. And I was ultimately looking for an avenue to become a pilot. So I attended the U of A, but it was really the Guard that started funneling me toward pilot training, because the active duty Air Force was deciding at the time that they had too many pilots, and the way to fix that was to actually not send people to pilot training, which turns out that's not really a way to we're actually seeing that now in terms of a pilot crisis in the Air Force, which we can talk to in a little bit. But I just had the opportunity to go to basic training and enlist and live these kind of two parallel existences where I actually had the ability to work after school and pay for college, had the opportunity to go to drill weekend and get paid to work. And also in the summer, I had a built-in job. But I also went to the U of A and got to go through ROTC and sort of see the active duty side of things and what they were doing. Ultimately, what it came down to was when it came time to graduate and go to pilot training, the Guard was the only game in town as far as going to pilot training. The active duty Air Force had zero pilot slots. The Air National Guard here in town had one in my hometown, and I just grabbed it as quick as I could, and off I went.
Well, it's you've also got a family history as well with the Guard. So I know your dad served in the, and I don't know if there were more Putnams other than your father, but I know he served. And I think your story is one that is unique for a lot of people because they don't understand. So you're able to enlist in the National Guard, and then there are pathways to joining the officer corps or going and doing other things. But people lose perspective that you get benefits of schooling, education. You've got that, you called it drill weekend. And for those who don't know what drill weekend is, that's 1 weekend a month that you get paid. You get to come out, you get to learn things. And you can do that all while you're going to school. So there's a lot of benefits. So for the high schoolers in this region, how would they go about finding out what those opportunities out of the Guard unit are?
Yeah, well, it's pretty easy. We have recruiters, number one. They could also go online, goang.com to get that sort of exposure. But you know, you touch on something that's really, really interesting. It's a double-edged sword. We all wear the uniform. And so when anybody sees a member of the Air National Guard, what they see is an Air Force member. And that's great. And that's what we want. Ultimately, when they go downrange to do whatever it is they're going to do with alongside the Air Force, you don't want to be able to tell people apart. But when it comes time to talk about the benefits and recruiting and the things and the opportunities that are available, it's very difficult to pick those things apart because of that identity of being lumped in with the Air Force. So what's available to the Air National Guard member, especially in the community, is the ability to stay in the community. You can go to school. You can do your drill weekend. You can have a career. We have many, many members out at the Air National Guard that have civilian careers, very successful civilian careers, and that is their primary source of employment, and they don't move. They don't move every 3 years. They stay rooted in their family. And one of the groups that I really like to talk about is the physicians out at the Air National Guard, because my father was one growing up, and that's how I knew about the Air National Guard. So I was very fortunate in that regard. We have some of the most talented physicians anywhere, the most experienced. And the reason that is they work every day in the community as physicians, and then they come out to the Air National Guard on drill weekend. And so they leverage that experience and those contacts within the community to provide just unparalleled access to medical care, training, and whatnot to the Guard. So I think what I would say to anybody in high school is what's available is all kinds of benefits without the association of you're going to have to leave your community and all of your plans that you can't serve unless you're sent around the world. You can serve right in your community, and you can have a very long career and not move.
Yeah, it's one thing I think people do miss is that obviously when you're walking around in your uniform and inside Tucson, they come up to you and go, oh, you must work at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. Now, there is a big part of the Guard out of Davis-Monthan, and we'll talk about that later. But it really is your 1,800 airmen or so that make up the 162nd are all citizen soldiers or citizen airmen. And they live in this community. They breathe in this community. You all know them. There's probably a lot of people out in the community that don't realize that they're folks that are playing ball with their kids, you know, the same parents, the same organizations, and the docs. A lot of them actually do serve in the Guard and at times put the uniform on and deploy overseas with the rest of the active duty Air Force. So you're right. It's kind of an interesting thing that a lot of people don't quite understand.
Exactly.
But we had two different paths. For me, I did 15 years active duty and got out as an F-16 pilot. And so looked at where the F-16 units were. And, you know, thank God I joined the Tucson Air National Guard because it changed my life. There's no doubt about it. You kind of knew that was going to be your path. But it didn't mean you got to go through training here, stay here, build hours here. You had to go elsewhere. So you went to pilot training in Texas. And then after that, where did you go to get your F-16 training and your seasoning?
Maybe a 6-year period. So I went to, after pilot training at Shepherd in Wichita Falls, Texas, I went to Luke Air Force Base for the B course. And that's right alongside all the active duty counterparts. I was the only Guard guy in my class. And from there, a variety of other trainings, the same Air Force training as any Air Force pilot. And then from there, I went to Syracuse, New York, which was something, you know, in and of itself. I moved up to Syracuse and got to enjoy winter. So that's where I seasoned. And so what's unique about the Air National Guard in Tucson is that we're a FTU, a formal training unit. So in order for a pilot to be really put to use here, they have to be quite experienced in order to be an instructor pilot, and you have to go somewhere to get that experience. And I certainly got it up there. It was a number of deployments, a lot of learning to fly in really bad weather, and then came back here to be an instructor pilot.
And the good thing is you came back.
Yes.
Because that's kind of what some of the challenges are. We send young fighter pilot wannabes off to pilot training. If they do well enough, they get to go off and get trained flying F-16s. But then you have to send them out for 3 years, and they can get distracted wherever they're serving to build their hours. What would you say, with your experience, how many of those folks that we send out do we generally get to come back because they haven't either fallen in love with the unit that they're flying with, or fallen in love with somebody from that area who really doesn't want to leave and move to Arizona?
Well, that's exactly right. There's some, I would say that's probably location dependent for many of them. You could send someone to, say, Denver to a unit, and they might not come back. They might like to ski, you know. Or you could send them to Syracuse, New York, and they might not like, you know, 10 feet of snow, and they come running back to the weather. There's a variety of reasons. The great news is that there's Guard units in every state. There's 25 fighter units, too, so they can stay. If they want to stay somewhere, they can. But they also have the opportunity to come back here as instructors. Recently, though, we have a new problem, which is we will send folks to pilot training, and there's not the ability for them to be absorbed in the rest of the Guard because the active duty is sending their own pilots. So we actually have done something unusual here, where we've brought people back from pilot training, and they've gone through the F-16 course, and then they stay at the unit, and we sort of tailor make a path for them where they will deploy with a variety of Guard units, but not actually move out there and become a part of the unit. They'll deploy. They'll go to. Recently, we had some guys. We sent them to Japan with the Minnesota Guard, and then they'll come back here and they'll be part of our ACA unit, which is the Air Defense Alert out at Davis-Monthan. So there's some changing dynamics in the Air National Guard where we are not able to send them out anymore.
Well, there's no, that's interesting to learn, because that is something new.
It is
something, obviously, it's scary to me, but I've been retired since 18, but I left the unit to go up to state in 13. So many changes that are going on. We talked a lot about the pilots so far, because we could probably, I'd enjoy sitting around talking about flying, but the fact of the matter is the pilots make up a fairly small percentage of both the members of the Tucson Guard, but also of the mission.
Absolutely.
So can you, as we head towards the bottom hour, can you outline the different missions that you have here, and also point out to the folks that, yes, there are members of the Guard on Davis-Monthan?
Yes, sure. First, I'll point out this. What was interesting to me, I've been in this job now for about a year and a half, and I've had the opportunity to sit across the table from some incredibly high-level members of both the government as well as the Air Force. I've sat across from the Secretary of the Air Force, the Chief, Chief of Staff of the Air Force as well, multiple senators, and even the Secretary of State. And I've told the story of the 162nd to these folks. And it's amazing that people are very familiar with parts of the mission that we do here. But once you tell them the entirety of it, they really just can't believe it. It's amazing what we do. So we are the largest F-16 fighter unit in the Air National Guard. So we have three squadrons of F-16s. So there's 78 of them. We also have the Air National Guard Air Force Reserve Test Center, which does exactly what the name implies, tests a variety of things for the F-16 and for other airframes across the Guard. Then we also have the MQ-9 unit, which is operated out of Davis-Monthan. They are a combat unit. So while the rest of the mission at the Guard is training, these folks are doing the actual mission. They are right now manning a line that's, without getting too specific, located somewhere in the Middle East, and they're flying combat missions. Then we have the launch and recovery element down at Fort Huachuca, which is four MQ-9s that are launched out of there physically, and they provide a service for both the unit at Davis-Monthan, but also the rest of the Guard in the States. They're able to fly those aircraft remotely because the weather's so good out here. They can launch the airplane and hand it off to, say, a unit in Syracuse, which actually, funny that you mentioned Syracuse, they actually are an MQ-9 unit, no longer an F-16s. And then back to Davis-Monthan again, I have to touch on the ACA mission, Aerospace Control Alert. So it's four F-16s on 24-hour alert, 7 days a week. And they've been there since September of 2001. So those are the missions across the spectrum of what we do. Davis-Monthan is a big part of it, and Fort Huachuca. So just geographically speaking, we're very unusual to have geographically separated missions like that. But really what we're known for really is the foreign training at the Air National Guard. In fact, last year we had an article written on us in Air and Space Forces magazine, Small Base, Big Impact, which has kind of become my tagline at this point.
Well, we'll definitely spend some time going back around in our time frame together out there at the Guard about the changing profile of the students we train out at the unit there. But also I do want to have you share the story of the stand-up of the alert detachment out at Davis-Monthan. You were in that squadron right after 9/11, and we'll go back to that story afterwards. We've got about two more minutes before we take our bottom of the hour break. So what are the challenges you're seeing, and how can the community help address some of those challenges?
Okay. Well, there's a variety of challenges, and that's part of having a really broad mission. It depends on which unit you're looking at. But if I were to look broadly, not just at our unit, but at the Air Force writ large, it's really recruiting. And if you want to drill down into the Air National Guard, you have a very small, as much as we do, the Air National Guard as a whole only has 107,000 members. So the odds of people coming in contact with someone in the Air National Guard and really knowing what it's about is really a challenge to communicate that those things that we just talked about are available to folks within the community. They often will think, I just cannot serve in the military because I just cannot leave my family, I just cannot leave my career, I have other things that I want to do. And that is very, very difficult to communicate. As a whole, we have some really talented recruiters, and we exceed the expectation, the benchmarks that have been set for recruiting just time after time. They're really amazing. We have some great relationships in the community with trade schools and other sources of recruiting. But what I would just like folks to know in the community is that anybody getting out of the active duty that they know, it's often they don't even know really what the opportunities are for their National Guard. They can continue to serve in that capacity. And then folks coming in, there are just so many benefits, so many abilities to serve in your local community and to serve your local community by doing so. There's a variety of missions that the Air National Guard does domestically. Just great opportunities.
Yeah, you hear about that, especially with all the stuff on the border, but we have had folks down there supporting border operations for decades. And we've had folks in the air supporting operations in the community. There's a big link with the community and with the Air National Guard. So that's the voice of Colonel Brant Putnam, the wing commander of the 162nd Wing. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. and we'll be back. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Engagement Hour, and I'm Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely still working the music behind the glass, trying to find some flying-related things and playing in and keeping us at ease here. My guest today is Colonel Brant Putnam, the wing commander of the 162nd Wing. It's hard. I always want to say fighter wing, but it's a wing, and it obviously is a wing because you've got so many missions, as you just talked about. Before we get down to talk about 9/11 and how that kind of changed a lot about the wing in and of itself from what it was prior to that, I want to talk about your relationship with the Tucson Airport Authority. There's always been some struggles on what the military needs are, and for people that may not have caught that earlier in the conversation, those 80 F-16s, that largest fighter training wing, F-16 training wing in the world, actually resides on a very small piece of land on the northwest part of the Tucson Airport. So when you're out there at the airport and you see small little planes taking off, making a lot of noise, that's Colonel Putnam's wing and the F-16s out there. But can you talk a little bit about Tucson Airport Authority as a sponsor of this show? So I'm a big fan of theirs. But about Danette Bewley and the relationship between the airport and all the construction going on out there right now.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So we are located on 92 acres at Tucson International, tucked away in a little corner. And by virtue of our size and just as long as we've been there since 1956, you know, we can't exist without a good relationship with Tucson Airport Authority. So we are partners, really, in the construction at Tucson International. One example is right now that the airport is under construction. And the ultimately, it's going to be three runways which serve the commercial airlines better, of course, better service for Tucson, but also it's three fighter-capable runways where we have the ability to use all three runways, which we haven't in the past. And they're just incredibly supportive for, we require special equipment to put on the runways in order to operate safely. And they're incredibly accommodating. They really understand the mission. They've actually been out to actually fly with us. Danette's been in the back seat, and she knows exactly what we're doing. She loves the mission, and she just really, the whole TAA just couldn't be more supportive.
So obviously, as F-16 pilots, we fly Tucson, well, used to, some of us, but some still do, like yourself. You fly Tucson all the time. So strong encouragement to everybody, as always, look first, fly Tucson. When I had Danette on, remember, we learned that even if you're going to fly out of Phoenix, first search it out of Tucson, and that will help the airlines recognize, because they track the searches and where people can't jump on the airline. That will help the airlines realize that, hey, we could use a few more direct flights out of Tucson. So please continue to go down that path. So let's go back to 9/11. You were, in the terms, a guard baby. You joined the guard. You completed your degree. You went off the pilot training, went to New York, came back, and you were flying since about 96, 97 with the, or maybe even 95 with the guard. I joined in 99. And you were in the 152nd. Fighter squadron, probably a captain still then.
Yeah,
a young captain.
Yep.
And 9/11 happened, and that changed both the wing and what we do out there. But because you were in the 152nd and at that time flying the most modern of the F-16s we had out there, that impacted your life pretty quick. Can you kind of tell that story about how that alert detachment came about and why it's still here today?
Yeah, it's really really interesting story. So We of course watched it all unfold on the news in the morning, and received a phone call to hey from work. Hey, you need to show up tonight at 8 o'clock and show up with crew rest, meaning 12 hours of rest. Okay, so I showed up, having no idea what we were doing, and what we were doing was standing up an alert detachment right there first at Tucson International, and this was September 12th. And the way we stood it up was a complete volunteer mission. The Air Force was basically asking, like, we need to man this alert detachment at Davis-Monthan, which coincidentally had just been given back. It was originally manned by Montana Air National Guard, which would fly down, and it was decided it just wasn't needed anymore. So we took it over. We stood up, we raised our hands, and it was in the true spirit of the Guard. It was a volunteer mission. It was something that we didn't do, we didn't know how to do, but we knew that we could figure it out. So we initially started sitting alert at Tucson that first night. on 12-hour shifts and just using some basic procedures that we had sort of dug up from guys who had previously been qualified to do that mission, and we started recalling each other. And then very shortly thereafter, the mission actually moved to Davis-Monthan. As Montana left those facilities over at Davis-Monthan, we just happened to move right back in them. We showed up there was a caretaker who was busy closing the facility down to give it back to the Air Force. And we took it over. We moved airplanes over there, 4 airplanes, and we started Sitting Alert.
And something folks may not completely understand is that first night, so you told me you were on alert that first night, you and another pilot we both know very well. We didn't have weapons. We're a training unit.
Right.
So even if they had launched you that night and you found yourself up, we effectively had the training bullets available to you.
That's absolutely right.
So there was nothing there. So when you got over to Davis-Monthan, and it took a couple days, I think it was 2 days sitting at TIA, then you went over to TIA. It wasn't much different over there. The A-10 had some AIM-9s, but what was it like getting checked out in weapons that we maybe only had simulated? And then how, do you remember the story of how we got those weapons?
Well, I remember somebody actually signing for a bunch of missiles and maybe even driving a truck full of missiles to get them out there. There was a tremendous spirit of we need to get this done, we need to make this happen. A lot of cutting through red tape, we'll say.
Yeah, it was, and that shows how important. One thing Colonel Putnam mentioned earlier is a lot of the airmen that serve at Tucson are also members of the civilian community and the working community. So there's several members that actually work at Raytheon, and the relationship between Raytheon and the guard being on the base, we as pilots and maintainers and anybody that's helping employing the F-16 rely on their weapons to be successful. There's always been a good exchange, but that night, in order to get some of the more advanced missiles that were necessary to do the mission correctly and secure the borders, it was that personal relationship that I believe, you're right, it was a truck to the back of a gate. The gate came open, things went on, signed a hand receipt. Might have gotten a little help from TPD when they pulled over that said truck with funny stuff in the back of their thing. But but it all got to DM and stood up. So that first year, from you going being an instructor pilot, flying with about a 50% split of U.S. and international students at the time. How were the next couple of years when we, and to this date, continue to run that alert detachment? How did it change kind of your perspective on being an F-16 pilot, but also on the perspective of the wing now that you're leading it?
Yeah. What I really enjoyed about it, and I enjoy it today, is the fact that it's a volunteer mission. We stood it up. We decided to man it. It was something that we really could have said, we're just a schoolhouse. We're just doing training. We don't do this mission. And it's something that we figured out in the spirit of volunteerism, really. Okay. We got into that, and there was some training involved. The mission evolved. So pretty soon it became, well, what are we going to do? Well, we need night vision goggles. Well, at the time, we didn't do night vision goggles. So we had to train everybody up. So that became the focus of the next couple of years. It takes a little while to train folks up to use night vision goggles and to fly at night. So we ended up spending the next couple of years getting folks qualified. And then as the requirements sort of took shape, we had to train to those specifics. Because at the time, there really were not a lot of procedures as to what we were really supposed to do. It evolved into being able to fly at night, being able to take pictures of airplanes, and a variety of things. What I really enjoy today is the fact that we've manned it continuously 24/7, 365 since that time, and we still do that. And it's also, again, just volunteers. We can't force anybody to go over there. I mean, I suppose we could if we wouldn't let it fail. But we don't ever have to do that. People really enjoy the fact that they can go out, the pilots and the maintainers can have the experience of working at the Guard and then go over and do this mission that's so important and be part of a real-world mission.
I think that is one of the keys. I know it's luckily, it had experience in the Block 42, which is the plane we were flying back then. So I got checked out relatively early, but it'd been years since I'd flown the Block 42. But I think that's the connectivity between training and a real world mission makes a big difference. So we're going to take a break right here, Brant, because when we come back, I do want to talk about what the main training mission is, and that is being the best F-16 training location, literally, in the world. So you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. This is Jump in Tucson. We'll see you after the break. And there's the song that led to the illustrious career of Colonel Brant Putnam, local high school kid. By the way, Pat, what high school did you go to?
I went to Sabino.
Okay, there you go. Sabino, the Sabino Sabercat.
That's it.
And that led that on the way. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. I am Ted Maxwell. And tomorrow on Jump in Tucson with Grant Kruger, you'll have Mackenzie O'Leary, executives of Tanca Verde Guest Ranch, and they were recently on the TV show Chopped. So I encourage you to listen in there. You'll get a little mix of foodieism and politics anytime you listen to Grant talk. So please join us on Jump in Tucson. So we talked about the alert debt, and that is an incredible story of how it stood up. We've talked about the fact that now the unit's got Reaper unit, started as Predators, now it's got a Reaper unit, an actual Reaper training site down at Huachuca. I mean, it's amazing stuff that occurs, and that's why so many people you get the opportunity to talk to can't believe that all happens at a single guard unit. Now, we got three squadrons. A lot of guard units are only single squadrons, so sometimes it's just they don't understand the magnitude of our base, especially since we spent all the years in the shadow of Luke Air Force Base, the largest at one time F-16 training unit, but they've obviously moved on. We're still flying those. So the training mission. I think in my time there, we went from predominantly U.S. to a mix to almost all international. Where are we sitting now, and what are some of the key challenges you've got training both the U.S. and foreign pilots out at the base right now?
Yeah, so we train 24 U.S., first of all, which are active duty as well as Air National Guard folks, and an occasional Air Force Reserve pilot as well.
And that's 24 pilots
24
a year?
24 pilots a year for okay. U.S. On the other side of that, we have 30, which are the foreign military sales or the internationals. Throughout the time that I've been there, I've been fortunate to be part of 33 countries training. So from 92 acres with 78 airplanes, we touch 33 countries. That's the magnitude of our international mission. The challenges that we have right now are we have older airplanes. The Air Force really is buying F-35s for the Air Force, but just not at a rate at which we have any chance of modernizing anytime soon. So we're flying some older F-16s. That's a challenge in and of itself. They break more. They require more man hours for each flying hour. But what we have that is really unusual is a really experienced, the most experienced maintenance.
I'm glad you go there.
Yep. Group of personnel there. Average age or average experience is 15.2 years on the airplane. We have one guy, 40 years. Whenever we point that out to visitors from the active duty Air Force, they just can't believe that we have that level of experience. What it has done for us is we were able to look out a while back, I'll call it 3 years, where 4 years maybe, where we said, you know what, these airplanes are breaking at a rate that is increasing. The severity of the breaks is something that where the airplanes are going to have to be sent off base in order to continue to maintain them and bring them back to fly. Well, we have the experience that was able to lean forward and to get trained to do depot level maintenance, meaning something that we would have to send to a facility to get repaired. They were able to get dispositioned because of their experience and competence to do it here. So that really is the secret as to why we continue to train. And there are two other formal training units left. Luke divested itself of the F-16. Holloman is an active duty in New Mexico that trains F-16 pilots, and Kelly in Texas. Right now, they are both at about 50% capacity of training due to their manpower, due to their maintenance. Our folks fix these airplanes day in and day out, and we continue to produce. So we continue year after year to produce 24 U.S. pilots and 30 of the foreign military sales.
And it is truly the quality of our maintainers and experience that makes the difference to do it safely. And to your point, 15 years on average, that's a full entire, almost a full entire 20-year military career when you add on their time in basic, their time in training. Most of the folks are retiring. They'll be lucky to have 15 or 16 years on a single platform. That's the average.
That's
then,
the average.
And then the 40. I mean, that's in leads back to that guard point. Those folks, the majority, if not all those hours, have been here.
Right.
And so they're raising their families here. They're involved in the community here. They're not leaving. Can they deploy? Yes. Generally, if they volunteer to do so, and a lot of those folks do, so we still support the worldwide mission. But to me, the key about the experience of the maintainers is not just the plane. You combine that with the experience of the instructors, and it allows you to do the international training mission. So can you talk a little bit about the challenge of teaching folks who English is not only their first, not their first language, it's sometimes not even touched until they come over to learn to fly in English?
Yeah, absolutely right. It's absolutely the experience of the pilots and the maintainers is really what allows us to do the international training mission, because it is challenging. They don't all go through the active duty Air Force pipeline like the U.S. folks do. So we sometimes don't know what we're getting when they come in. And it's the experience that allows us to do that. It also, it just allows us to accept missions that we otherwise couldn't accept. One example recently was in the news is training Ukrainian pilots. So we trained the initial 12 pilots for Ukraine. We did so very much like the ACA detachment. It was a, can you do this? And we said, you know, we have a history of training countries like Poland, Bulgaria, and Slovakia. Yeah, we can do this. So we raised our hand to do that mission. And it was it was incredible because there was really no structure to the program. We were just told, train these guys. And we said, well, what do you want in the end? They said, well, we don't know yet. That hasn't been decided. We don't know what kind of airplanes they're getting, what kind of missions we want them to fly. We just want you to train them. So we had the expertise to throw them into a course that already existed and make it up as we go along. And it was only due to experience, to be able to adjust on the fly, to not know what sort of flights we were going to accomplish 3 weeks from now, and to be able to adjust as we went.
And there was a lot of pressure on that one. It was high visibility. It was coming from literally the top down. And we're talking Air Force top. It's not just the Guard thing. This is where the Guard serves Air Force missions because we are part of the Air Force. And I want to go back to the experience on the maintainers, because everybody goes, oh yeah, but that's the pilots are the ones that are dealing with, you know, being in a single seat fighter, teaching somebody who's 2 miles away with you going 400 miles an hour talking. But it's really incredible that our maintainers can do it where those students are in a plane by themselves, working through maintenance issues in a language and in maintenance talk that only maintainers that have the experience that you've got out of the Guard can do.
That's correct. That's correct.
So it is really amazing. So you've been in the seat now about 18 months. What's the biggest lesson learned?
Well, I think that what I've learned is that more or less my job is to tell the story. Everybody seems to have an appreciation for a small part of our mission. So my job is to advocate for the full spectrum of those missions, to show the impacts of resources and training on each of the individual parts, and to tell the story. Because of that experience, the operation runs. It just runs itself. And so I have the luxury of looking out and assessing, you know, what's ahead. What could we do? Where are our strengths and our opportunities for growth? And it's just, I really just tell the story. I just tell the story of what we do and what we can do. And I find that has been more instrumental in securing our future than anything. There have been times where we've been looked at to possibly lose a squadron. And in telling the story of what we provide, those things get reversed, and we're now being looked at as, what can you do more of? Where can we put more equipment? Where can we put more people? So it's just tremendous.
Well, and that's great to hear, because defending having three squadrons, having the test squadron, and we didn't really talk about some of the times how that test, the work over the test center will show up almost right away on our side of the house before it gets anywhere else, always makes you a target. Especially in the Guard, the you know, no member of Congress is going to say, yeah, take my Guard unit away. And so they always look to try to downsize. And you're doing a great job defending that in keeping it alive. So hopefully, One thing that Colonel Putnam hasn't mentioned, I didn't mention, is he's sitting in a seat that's occupied by a one-star general officer. So I believe your promotion's probably sitting around the Senate right now, just waiting for Senate confirmation. So I hope that happens really quick, because you're doing a great job leading the wing. What's the last thought that you want to leave with folks to think about the Guard?
I just want to reemphasize for the community that you have the opportunity to serve. We need you. We want you. I promise whatever it is that you're looking to do, there's a way to do it in the Guard. There's a way to have it all. You can have your job in the community. You can have your career. You can have your education. And you can serve. And you can learn to do something that's really important and work with some really great people.
And you don't have to start at the top. You don't have to start, coming in with your college degree, looking to be a pilot. You can join anyway, because that's how you did it. There's a lot of different ways. And the majority of the wing makes up those support assets, the maintainers, the folks that have been here, that have lived in the community, that haven't left. We've got lots of families out there as well. So, Brant, just want to say thank you for all you've done, all the service. We've talked about how careers take amazing turns, and you never know where they're going to end up. But right now, there could be nobody better leading the 162nd. So thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk to Jump in Tucson. Please join Chris DeSimone on Wake Up Tucson in the morning, and then stay around for Jump in Tucson and Grant Krueger. Everybody have a great week, and I look forward to talking with you next week.